You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey folks, Aaron here. Before we begin, just a heads up that today's episode contains the story of a traumatic birth. Listener discretion is advised. Tinkering in his small shop just off Broadway, Joseph Trust was busy concocting skin creams and making promises. He was going to make women beautiful, after all, and himself rich in the process. And he would do both of those things through manipulation and deceit. Joseph did this by transforming himself into an alter ego, Felix Gourad, a chemist and doctor. But behind this sophisticated facade was a difficult snake oil salesman and general scoundrel about town. To those who really knew him, and there weren't many, he was less of a Superman and Clark Kent and more of a Jekyll and Hyde. One of his items, though, was a canary in the coal mine for the changing times. On August 8th of 1840, he advertised a woman's hair removal powder on the front page of the New York Daily Herald. He wrote, "We could never think of falling in love with a woman whose fuzzy face bears a resemblance to the back of a half-picked goose and wonder how anyone else ever could." But ladies removing their body hair wasn't anything new, of course, and can be traced back thousands of years to civilizations across the world. Egyptian women sometimes removed their head and pubic hair. Elizabethan women did away with their eyebrows. Ancient Romans used a myriad of pumice stones and tweezers that were at a lady's disposal. In America, though, female hair removal had yet to be commodified and institutionalized. But then, that all started to change. In 1880, the King Camp Gillette Company created the first modern razor. It appeared at a time when the upper and middle class continued their efforts by separating themselves from the working class. Personal hygiene was utilized, arguably weaponized at times, to fight against what was considered to be improper. By the early 1900s, to be clean-shaven was a basic expectation of good breeding. And so here, Joseph Trust was tapping into a veritable goldmine of class anxieties. Upper-crust Victorian Americans, you see, were in the habit of clinging to any life raft that would keep them floating above the masses. Coded advertising language meant that women weren't directly asked to do something as masculine as getting rid of their 5 o'clock shadow. Instead, they were just smoothing their surfaces out, dissolving the rough bits, and bleaching away their nonconformity. And of course, manufacturers knew that many women, an established economic force by this time, would be drawn in. Blade refills, new designs, and fancy creams kept them coming back for more. Charles Darwin, too, weighed in on the body hair issue with a hot take. In his book, The Descent of Man, he claimed that humans have less fur than their ape ancestors because less hairy mates are more sexually attractive. We evolve out of hair. Following that logic, he believed that excessive hair puts a person in closer proximity to a primitive state. Closer, to use his words, to the savage. It seems that women who wore their hair wild and untamed were being boxed out of proper society. But if proper society wasn't going to take them, there was another place that would welcome them. for better or for worse, with open arms. The stage. I'm Aaron Mankey. Welcome to The Sideshow. All we know for sure is that Julia Pastrana only ever wanted to be loved. It's evident from the few words that she left behind. Her complete life story has been a treasure hunt for contemporary scholars, as they've tried to find clues scattered across the pages of history. But sometimes, the dead have their way of keeping secrets. Our story begins on a quiet day in Sinaloa, Mexico. It's a state that occupies a narrow stretch of land that sits between the Sierra Madre Occidental Mountain Range to the east and the Sea of Cortez to the west. The terrain is carved with peaks and valleys and covered in fertile soil. In 1834, Sinaloa was recently freed from Spanish rule, but for the previous 300 years, the indigenous population had been squeezed by colonization and ravaged by disease and war. It's here that we meet our two hunters, or as some claim, they were herders, walking a familiar, worn path up a mountain, tracking their game. Just up ahead sat a cave, its rocky mouth daring them to enter. So they did. And what they found there startled them. They found a woman, haggard, half feral, and captive. But she wasn't being held by just anyone. No, she told them she was being imprisoned by a bear. She pleaded for their help, but the hunters were ill-prepared, so they told her that they would come back with assistance. Just as they turned to leave, though, they were thwarted. The bear had come home. The surprise left them with no choice. They had to act fast. But then they saw something else. The bear was holding a cub in his arms. Legend tells us that the cub was this woman's daughter, the product of this interspecies hostage situation, and the baby was nothing like the hunters had ever seen before. Black fur covered her face and body, although she cried and cooed like any other human infant. It seemed that she was half person and half beast. The infant, Julia, was taken from her mother and brought to the city, violently altering her life path and the woman she would become. You see, women are often treated as blank slates for the stories of men, and the tale of Julia Pastrana would be no different. For her, this was just the beginning. What we do know now is that she was born with two congenital conditions, hypertrichosis terminalis, which caused dark hair to grow all over her body, and gingival hyperplasia, which caused overgrown gums. Some scholars believe that she could have been a member of the Acoxi people. Promotional materials from later in her life would claim that she was a member of a root digger tribe, a derogatory term given to a number of culturally separate and distinct communities in the region. Julia came to live in the home of Pedro Sanchez, one of Sinaloa's governors, and a man with a penchant for curiosities. There she became a servant, and also was said to have taken on the role of live-in entertainer. We know that she left his home in 1854, although the details of that exit are hazy. But it's said that she eventually came into contact with three men, Miguel Retes, Francisco Sepulveda, and most famous of all, Theodore Lent. We don't know the exact details of their arrangement or how she came under their employ. Newspapers tell us that in the company of her male comrades, she boarded the SS Orizabav and left Veracruz for New Orleans. She arrived in the port city on October 28th of 1854, took a steamer ship up the Mississippi River to St. Louis, and then finally went on to New York City. And it's here that we meet her again, reincarnated as someone new. According to promotional posters, she had become known as the Marvel Hybrid and the Bear Woman. She debuted at Gothic Hall on Broadway, a tiny form in a red dress, dancing to a tinkling piano. According to the New York Tribune, the eyes of this lusus natura beam with intelligence, while its jaws, jagged fangs, and ears are terrifically hideous. Nearly its whole frame is coated in long, glossy hair. Its voice is harmonious, for this semi-human being is perfectly docile and speaks the Spanish language. The papers compared her arrival to the spectacle of Joyce Heth and claimed that Barnum himself was being, well, out-Barnumed. Theodore, though, decided that he would get the upper hand over all of them. He would marry Julia in secret and become her legal guardian with all the rights that afforded him. And marry they did, on November 9th of 1855. Her other managers were furious, but Julia stood by and made it clear that it was her choice. She wouldn't give up her husband for anyone, she said. But as we know, the idea of choice in these situations is often an attempt to mitigate harm or side with the lesser of evils. It has been reported that Julia truly loved Theodore and felt that he saw her for who she truly was. But some scholars have speculated that he also saw dollar signs when he looked at Julia and only wanted to possess her for his own gain. And this is how things went for a good long while. Theodore kept recreating Julia, further embellishing her act with songs and dances and costume changes. And in all of it, her advertisements teased that she was nothing more than a domesticated beast. One man, Dr. Alexander B. Mott, wrote a letter of certification for Julia claiming that she was a hybrid of a human and an orangutan. He called her a mysterious animal and mused over her missing tail. So while her contemporary white-bearded ladies were marketed as beacons of Victorian propriety, beautiful oddities, if you will, hirsute women of color were often billed as freaks of nature. Not only was her womanhood in question, but her very humanity, and it was upon this platform that she toured all over North America, her story and body being exploited at every turn. Whereas the papers knew Barnum dealt in humbuggery and hoax, they believed that Julia was the bona fide real deal. It seems that her audiences were largely content with believing that she was something less than human. And as they looked at all the cash that flowed in, Theodore couldn't have been more pleased. Everyone seemed to have an opinion about Julia's looks, so much so that she was shut down for obscenity. On November 5th of 1857, she took the stage as the star in a play in Berlin. But unbeknownst to her and Theodore Lent, spies from the German police were in the audience. And unlike other places Julia had traveled to, German authorities were on guard against displays that they considered to be tasteless, degrading monster shows. The police called her appearance immoral and quite literally feared for their children. Obstetricians in Germany weighed in, worried that pregnant women would miscarry at the sight of her. They also tossed around threats of maternal impression, the idea that those in the family way were infinitely susceptible to any kind of upset, and that those anxieties would manifest in the body of the child. The authorities were afraid that more babies would be born looking like Julia. This, of course, caused her great pain. It was when people saw her as a full person that she felt truly animated, truly alive and actualized. But so often, this wasn't the case. A friend once noted that there was always a light fog of sadness that hung over her, resigned to a life and narrative that kept her humanity locked away in the shadows. After the backlash in the press, Theodore reimagined the performance as a set of short song and dance numbers, a burlesque act, and private meetings. All for a fee, of course. Julia attracted the attention of Hermann Otto, a sympathetic German circus showman. He wrote that, for those who knew her, she was warm, thoughtful, and spiritually gifted with a sensitive heart and mind. It affected her very deeply in her heart, having to stand beside people instead of with them, and to be shown as a freak for money, not sharing any of the everyday joys in a home filled with love. But then something happened that held the potential to change all of that. In 1859, she and Theodore were in Moscow. Their tour was keeping them busy and afloat, but she was starting to feel strangely different. It wouldn't be long before she realized why. She was pregnant. Now, instead of Julia being told that she was a risk to expectant mothers, she was becoming one. Obstetricians grew concerned with this news. They feared that her particularly narrow pelvis would prove to be dangerous. At best, birth is a physically traumatic experience. At its worst, it can be deadly. Her labor began on March 20th of 1860, and she was attended to by a handful of doctors. What we do know is that the doctors used forceps to help the baby out. We can imagine that they were clamped to his skull or to his shoulders, crushing him. At around 4 in the afternoon, he was born. And as the doctors held him for the first time, they were horrified. The baby's body was covered in thick, black hair, just like his mother. Tragically, the baby, unnamed in the history books, died 35 hours later, and Julia would fare no better. First came the chills, and then the shaking. An intense pain in her abdomen was followed by unbearable swelling and finally a fever. It's said that a crowd of spectators gathered around Julia's deathbed. If Theodore sold tickets, we don't know, but could we put it past him? It's said that her last words were, "I die happy. I know I have been loved for myself." Julia followed her baby into death on March 25th of 1860. According to the Romantics, she died of a broken heart. This, of course, is nonsense. The broken heart theory was just yet another story about her that became repeated. Just another tale that was tacked onto her body's canvas. In the end, doctors listed her official cause of death as inflammation of the uterine membrane and the lining of the abdominal cavity. It wasn't a beautiful death in which Julia slipped away gracefully. It was brutal. Theodore, however, was not one to mourn. Instead, he had an idea. Death is usually the end for most of us, but the longest stretch of Julia's career was just beginning. The unscrupulous Theodore Lent, committed to never losing a dime, sold the bodies of his wife and child to a professor at Moscow University. Whether they commanded a high price or not depends on how you determine their value, but they lined his wallet with the equivalent of about $84,000 in today's currency. In the lab, Julia and her son's body were subjected to a top-secret cocktail of embalming liquids. It was reported that since the child's body was quite fresh, it was easy to mummify. Julia, on the other hand, proved to be more difficult. She had to be injected several times over a long period in order to mask the smell of decay. All the while, the professor took photographs and notes, recording diligently as the human husks on his table changed color and shape. After 6 months of work, it was time for the postmortem debut at the University of Moscow's Anatomy Museum. In life, just as in death, Julia Pastrana became a sensation. The embalming process also had a curious side effect. It seemed that her dissection had finally proven her humanity. The papers were surprised to report that, after a grueling internal examination, her body was indeed human. She wasn't an ape, after all. The widower Theodore Lent, though, stuck around. It's said that he liked the mummies so much and was so impressed by that Moscow University professor's work that he bought back the bodies of his wife and son for nearly twice what he'd sold them. And like most showmen of that age, Theodore already had his next destination in mind. Piccadilly Circus in London, home to curious wonders from all over the world. In the early months of 1862, he set up shop. He dressed his dead bride in a Russian dancing dress she had made herself, and his son in a sailor suit. 2 years later, in 1864, the bodies of Julia and her baby were toured through Sweden. Meanwhile, Theodore was off searching for another break, and in Bohemia, he found it. Well, her. He had learned about Marie Bartel, another bearded woman. It is said that her family kept her locked away, but somehow Theodore managed to ingratiate himself with her family enough to seek her hand in marriage. Her father obliged, but made Theodore promise that he wouldn't show her for money. But unfortunately, this was before Google and background checks. Just a few days in, Theodore stole her shaving kit. He made grand plans to take her through Europe and gave her a new name to match them. Zenora Pastrana. Yes, Theodore had decided to style her as Julia's long-lost sister, and for a decade they toured with Europe's best circuses and entertained royals. By the 1880s, interest in their act began to wane, so they decided to put some roots down and open a wax museum in St. Petersburg, Russia. Julia and her baby, though, had been left behind, on loan to a Viennese museum, with Theodore being paid for the privilege. But the quiet, settled life wouldn't last long for Theodore and his second wife. It's said that he began to lose his marbles and was eventually installed in a Russian insane asylum, where he would never be heard from again. It might sound like a satisfying ending, but our story doesn't stop there. Free from his gravitational pull, Marie now struck out on her own, with the bodies of Julia and her baby in tow. But the threesome would never be a permanent sideshow fixture. The following year, Marie married a much younger man and left show business. And when she did, she passed her mummified partners on to a German showman. By the late 1890s, the pair was not longer of much interest to the medical or scientific communities. We lose track of the two for a while, until they surface at an amusement park in Oslo. Their home there wasn't an anatomy museum, but a chamber of horrors, displayed alongside various body parts and bottled sea monsters. Horrific, I know. And this would be Julia and Baby's story for the intervening decades. They rotated in and out of storage units, appearing at various installations, before being sent off to warehouses. Collectors came knocking over the years, offering top dollar for the remains. Julia went on one final tour, but it wouldn't last long. While visiting a town in Sweden, local authorities used a law from 1875 to threaten confiscation of the mummies if they were put on display. After that, she was sent to the winter headquarters of a fairground in Oslo, and it's there that she fell to pieces. Vandals tore her dress, ripped her child's arm off, and broke her jaw. It seems that Julia and her child were treated in death exactly as she had been in life, displayed for entertainment, handled like a possession, and decorated with whatever narrative sold the most tickets. And when they no longer served their purpose, they were locked away and left to rot. Human beings, seen as nothing more than sideshow props. It's always alarming when you find body parts at the town dump. It was 1979 in the suburbs of Oslo, Norway, and some children who were playing in a garbage heap found a severed, mummified arm. The owner wasn't immediately clear, but she was soon found. Julia Pastrana stood quietly in an abandoned caravan nearby, missing life and limb. Time hadn't been kind to her, but neither had the world. She was quite literally torn apart, stuffing exposed and sutures popped. Some of her skin and clothing were missing, and to further compound the cruelty, so was her baby. She would resurface 10 years later in a janitor's closet in the basement of the Forensic Institute of Oslo. It's clear that no one still quite knew what to do with her, and today, we have to wonder what took so long to figure it out. But by the 1990s, rumbles could be heard through the hallowed academic halls of Oslo. Scholars, historians, and activists began questioning the university's decision to keep her body. And across the pond in New York, a play was being produced about her life. Its story shocked audiences rather than entertained them, and it drummed up interest in a petition to the Mexican embassy in Oslo to send Julia home. But as was the case with Sarki Bartman's repatriation, Julia and her supporters faced a long, difficult battle with high-minded institutes that deemed themselves worthy to hold her captive in the name of science. This claim was dubious at best, and finally the institution relented. In February of 2013, she was dressed in a traditional huppel garment and laid in a coffin. The rods and bolts that were used for exhibiting her body in death were removed and placed at her feet. And with that, she was flown home to Sinaloa and greeted with a welcome fit for royalty. There, she would finally rest in a tomb dressed in a riot of flowers from well-wishers from across the globe. It had taken a century and a half, but the world had finally seen her and loved her for who she truly was. Everyone wants to be loved, but for the right reasons, of course. So if there's someone out there who you truly appreciate, if they bring a brightness to your life, maybe some joy, or they just make being here a little easier, maybe now is a good time to let them know. But we're not quite done here just yet. And if you stick around through this brief sponsor break, Robin will tell us one more tale from the sideshow and help us see what happens when the drama leaves the stage and heads to the courtroom.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On July 2nd of 1853, a crowd appeared at the Halls of Justice in Manhattan, a formidable complex that housed both a court and a detention center for New York City. Curious onlookers had heard about one of the cases on the docket that day, and they were looking for a free show. William Char, you see, had a bone to pick with P.T. Barnum. He had visited Barnum's American Museum and was angry about it. Standing before the justice, Char recounted his experience from the previous day. After paying his quarter for admission, he entered the museum. Of the thousands of curiosities on display awaiting visitors, Char was there to see a brand new feature, Madame Josephine Clofullia, billed as the Bearded Lady. Madame Clofullia was a hit in part due to who she was behind the beard. She was a fair-skinned woman of Swiss descent, born to a class which gave her access to many refined social circles. Mid-19th century America was a time of high gender anxiety. Gender was conceived as a strict binary. You were either male or female. You performed one or the other, but never neither, and certainly not both. But here she was, a strikingly beautiful woman, just, you know, with a beard. When Char was faced with this performance, he was incredulous. He quickly deemed Madame Clofullia to be an imposter. She had to be a man in disguise. Char, standing amongst innumerable humbugs, decided that this gaffe had gone too far. He believed he had been cheated, so he took Barnum and Clofullia to court. And there, at the place where criminals and corruption rubbed elbows, Josephine Clofullia, in her lovely Victorian gown, stood listening to a stranger challenging her womanhood. Character witnesses were called upon to certify Josephine's legitimacy. Fortune Clofullia, her husband of 3 years, brought up the two children she'd birthed, one of whom was still alive. Her own father backed him up. Barnum spoke his piece, too. He claimed that he had paid her a large sum for her exhibiting work, and from the best of his knowledge, she was a woman. In fact, he said, he had her examined by a few physicians, including one Dr. Mott, the same man who had called Julia Pastrana's basic humanity into question. Even Dr. Koval of New York City's prison chimed in. He had interviewed her, he reported, and was perfectly convinced that, in spite of her beard, she was indeed a lady. The magistrate was convinced and the suit was dismissed. Horace Greeley's New York Tribune reported the whole story in great detail the very next day. His paper had a circulation of about 200,000 throughout the 1850s, which made it one of the largest daily papers in the United States. And imagine this, Horace Greeley was also a good friend of P.T. Barnum. Almost immediately, Barnum was suspected of arranging the whole ordeal with Char. Why? Well, either because interest in Madame Clofullia wasn't as enthusiastic as the showman had hoped, or to make sure his museum, with a bona fide bearded lady, became a top destination for visitors on the 4th of July. And it worked. For better or for worse, the article that spread throughout the nation's papers made the title Bearded Lady synonymous with the name Madame Clawfulia, at least for some time. In America, she continued to travel as a professional, covering her beard so that passersby wouldn't get a free show. She was given what Julia and so many other hirsute women of color were never afforded, the label of respectability. The papers sung her praises, championing her beauty, and writing that she had the finest set of whiskers that anyone had ever seen.
Sideshow was written by Robin Miniter, with narration by me, Aaron Mankey. Research for the series was by Robin Miniter, Taylor Hagerdorn, and Sam Alberti, with production assistance from Josh Thane, Jesse Funk, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. Grim & Mild Presents was created in partnership with iHeartRadio. You can learn more about this show and everything else from Grim & Mild over at grimandmild.com. And as always, thanks for listening.